You can't make the most of your data if it's stuck in different silos. If it's scattered across the cloud, on-prem, and with your apps, then it's hard to access, hard to work with, and increasingly expensive. Now you can see it all and manage it all from one place. Welcome to Data Done Right. You can start managing your data, not your infrastructure. It's unified, simple, secure, and it's only with a Pure Storage platform. Get started at purestorage.com.
Hello.
Ahoy. This is War with a Mate.
Welcome. I'm Andy.
I'm James.
And we're playing all of Campaign for North Africa, SBI's behemoth.
It's a big game. They made it. Or Richard Berg made it. He was the mastermind behind it. As a bit of a joke for the future. And here we are, in the future. We got flying cars. We've got universal healthcare. We've got no disease. There's been no diseases that have spread worldwide in, well, I can't remember how long. And
I've certainly never lived through one.
No. Well, no one would now. It's the future. That would be crazy. Everything's going pretty well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Globally.
Yeah, this is the worst thing happening.
Oh, yeah, look how privileged we are. And you people have tuned in, a crucible of your own making, to forge yourselves in the hardship that you seldom find elsewhere. It's hard to really test yourself when everything else in the world is so gentle and delicate. But we're here to help you with that. We're here to be that little oasis of pain. It's important for you to suffer once in a while. So let's get out your masochism flutes. And sorry, that sounded quite phallic. That's not what this is about.
Okay.
It's not that kind of podcast. This is a podcast where we're talking about playing the game. And we've done just that today. We've played some of the game.
It was a good one.
It was. We've done more air stuff. Today was air stuff because today was the start of Opstage 3 of turn 2.
We're there.
We are there. We're about to hit the halfway turn.
Yeah.
Because we're doing six practice turns, if you don't remember. Then we're doing the full game. And it has, yeah, it's been a year. It's getting close to a year anyway. We got the game in November. We started recording early December.
Released.
And we released late January.
Yeah.
So we've got a few milestones, a few anniversaries.
Yeah.
And we haven't hit any of them yet. But we've...
They're coming up.
Yeah, they're in the future.
But yeah, we've handled the organization phase.
Yeah, we've done all those bits and bobs. We've got a little bit of homework, as always, for our water. And the hot weather means that we need to get rid of more water than we expected, which is just swell. I love getting rid of more of my water. You know what? I think you're the only one who's rolled bad weather.
I think I'm the only one rolling weather.
Yeah. I rolled the sandstorm.
You rolled weather in turn one because you had initiative.
Yeah, I rolled the sandstorm, I think.
Yeah.
Did I?
No, you rain.
Rain, yes, not sandstorm.
I don't think we've had a sandstorm yet. No, we haven't.
No, that'd be exciting.
We've had two hot weathers, a bunch of normals, and one rainstorm.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, what we've had is half and half.
Yes. It's been hot.
It's not been a bunch of normal weathers. Half the time it's normal.
Yeah.
Is that what we're actually in for? Is it going to be mostly, not mostly, but is it going to be an even split of
bad and
foul
good.
Weather is the table. Foul weather.
I think, yes.
Oh.
Because I think in winter you can't get hot, but rainstorms are more likely. And then summer, hot is almost as big as normal.
Winter, you can't get hot.
No.
You sound like a pensioner's nightmare.
Horrible.
I mean, it would be.
Oh, yeah.
That's what gets them.
Yeah. So we handled an organization.
We did.
And took to the air.
Oh, the air. And we split our forces. Mine, supposedly the superior air force of this portion of history.
You have more planes, I'll say.
I have more planes. And at the moment, I have fewer active planes, I believe. I did manage to get a bunch of supplies to my airfields over on map B last op stage, which meant I was able to have a bit more ammo available. So that was good. I could tap into those last drops of ammunition for the bombers without completely droughting myself. So I flew off my bombers. That was good. And they've taken to the sky. I did 3 bombing missions and 2 strafing missions.
And I sent 2 lots of planes up to do air protection above the 7th and the 4th.
Yes.
And I attacked one of your supply dumps.
A very important supply dump.
Yes.
This is the one that is behind my wall, the one that's been moving up along the northern road. So that they've been all bolstered by this supply dump that I finally got my shit together, and I finally started a good supply convoy with this supply dump as the nexus point between them all. And you saw that, and you thought, well, I'll go for that.
I was, because I heavily committed to attacking it, and I would look so foolish if you'd baited me with a dummy supply dump.
470-odd bombs.
Yes. Well, now they're in Alexandria, I'm just dropping them. If the planes are ready and they have stuff on them.
May as well.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I don't think you'd be so concerned about it being a fake supply dump if I didn't do the fake truck thing that I've been doing. Because I did actually drive trucks to that supply dump. And I feel like if I hadn't done the fake truck thing, you would have been thinking, well, this is definitely a normal supply dump. He's driven trucks there. But maybe part of the fact I've messed around with my trucks before made you think maybe these are all fake trucks that he's driving back and forth.
It was partially that. Partially it's not that far from... Is it Bardia?
It's Bardia, yeah.
It's not that far from Bardia, so I was like, it could be like some enticing bait. And also, last upstage, I did find a dummy supply dump with the long-range desert group.
Yes.
So you are making them, because you made that one.
That one was at the start of the game.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I got 2 reals and 1 fake off with. Or the inverse? No, I think it's... No, it is the inverse. I got 2 fakes and maybe 2 reals. I definitely got 2 fakes.
Yeah.
So, yes, I've put them out there. That one was real, as you found out, because you bombed it. You committed a lot of bombs. You got to the very end column. You did 470 plus bombs. Yeah. 471 is the cutoff for the highest column.
Yeah, I did 474.
Yeah.
Which could have destroyed up to 70% of it.
I think it's 75, isn't it?
70, I think.
70, yeah.
And then I also strafed the supply dump.
You did.
Which can do up to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a world where that supply dump was wiped out, which would have been nice. But I ended up getting 50% of it, which, depending how heavily stacked it is hopefully quite a blow.
Oh, that's something I need to check. I didn't think about this. I just took it as gospel. That 70%, well, I say 70, the way it ended up being, it was 30 from the bombs, it was 20 from the strafe.
Yeah.
I don't know, is that just a collective 50%, or is that you take off 30% and then you take off 20 of what remains?
It should have been that, I guess, yeah, because they were distinct events.
Yeah, I don't know, we'll have to check that, because I just took off 50, taking that to be how it works. But now I'm second-guessing myself.
No, that's a good point.
There will be some sort of sequence of events in there where it talks about... I'd expect there would be, because it's so detailed.
Because I think the way I bombed it and then strafed it, the way we did it.
Yeah.
That's a good point, actually.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. The thing that popped in my head there was what we talked about last week, where if you go and take ammo from a supply dump, it thirds it every time.
Yes.
So that's what I was thinking. There's got to be some sort of sequence, some chain of command of different sequence of actions, but we'll have to check. Either way, best case scenario, you've taken out 50.
Yeah,
and that's a lot. Even if it's 30 and then 20, that's still a significant amount. And they were meant to be bolstered, my wall, by that supply dump. And you had close air patrol for the 7th and the 4th, 4th Indian and the 7th Armored.
Yeah,
and the 7th Armored I've just left out there. Fair. After the whole kerfuffle with the 4th Black Shirts, I thought, we'll leave them out there. They can have a bit of a breather. The 4th Indian, however, they've been a point of contention for me in the past when it comes to air missions. This was no different.
This is the second battle that's happened directly above their heads.
It was, because I did try to strafe them. And I sent 6 planes to try and do so.
And I'd committed pretty heavily, so those 6 planes were met by 33 planes.
And what's incredible is that of those
Half
6
of them
planes, yeah, 6 of my planes went there, 3 of them survived, which is incredible. Not only that, but one of the ones that was shot down, the pilot actually limped back to base. The plane was destroyed, but he's wandering through the desert right now to get back.
But two of you guys who didn't have pilot ratings yet but had got shot down died.
No, one of them survived. He was the last one.
Sorry, yes, I knocked down three. I didn't realize. I knew I knocked down three and one survived. I wasn't sure which was which.
Oh, I wouldn't be keeping track of a guy if he hadn't done anything in the past.
Oh, okay.
He would simply be dead.
Okay.
I think in the main game I will, just so I can keep track of these pilots who survived these horrible events and then continue to get kills.
Yeah.
So one guy, bit of an accolade, has downed someone before. He's walking back to base. And three overall got off. They didn't pull anything off with that strafe. The fourth Indian were not harmed. I did commit another 15 planes.
To the 16th Infantry Battalion.
And that did pay off.
Yes, you got a tow point out of them.
I did. I sprayed them with some rounds from the air, took out a guy, well, 100 guys. So, small victory there. They didn't have any protection.
Well, the way I'd put the air patrol over, because those two were next to each other.
Yes.
But I committed to the ones, I wanted to keep the 4th safe over the 16th. And obviously you don't know. How many planes are going to both until it's declared?
Yeah, so it paid off overall for me, I think. It was a small thing, but I wasn't expecting a whole lot from 6 planes in the first place. And then the other 15, I'll take a tow point for that. Your
Pretty smooth air battle as well. We got through it in less... I mean, it was only 6 planes, but I had to roll for 30. And we got through it in...
maybe half an hour, if that... I think we've really streamlined that.
Yeah.
I think, I was saying that when we were doing it. I did take a moment and asked if you feel like the turns are getting shorter.
Yeah, it's certainly the air combat's got streamlined. I think that's simple and intuitive enough that we can just sort of sit down and blast out air combat pretty quick. I am looking forward to when there's, because it will happen at some point, like 100 planes meet 100 planes.
Yeah. I don't even think it'll be too long, though, because that, for the most part, if that was the situation, for example, it's one-on-one, so we just have 100 rolls to do, maybe up to 200 rolls if both planes survive.
Yeah.
But even then, I don't think that's particularly long. I think that's maybe an hour.
Yeah.
And that's worst-case scenario. I think figuring out the difference between them with attack air and the maneuverability is relatively quick.
Yeah.
That's not... anywhere as bad as I thought it was going to be when we first started. I always thought it would be fun. I thought it would be really long as well.
I was thinking it was going to be, because it's individual planes where everything else is on an operational level. I was like, is this going to be very slow? No, they just made it streamlined in a way the rest of the game fundamentally isn't.
The rest of the game is, it's a piece of art. You know, that's what people call it. I disagree still.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a prank, but it's good fun. And then I went and did 3 bombing runs.
You're really fucking up that road.
I am. I went back to your road that your supplies come along, the northern road, went further east of that wall that I've got, and I dropped 330 bombs on one area, 330 on another, both of which are guaranteed to destroy those pieces of road. And then 44 bombs on a third. All of them were successful.
Yeah.
All of them destroyed a piece of road.
That's some going.
Well, that is another 12 breakdown points if you want to drive over it.
Yeah, that's all right.
That no, not when you're going over the other pieces of broken
road.
No,
it's bad for tanks. It's fine for... It's getting to a point where I'm going to have to roll truck breakdown, but it's going to be on the low...
It's going to be on the low end, but all I need is consistent low end, because you have to supply these guys regularly.
Yeah, I had a plan before that happened that I'm still doing. That.
Right, yeah, I needed to bring this up, because I declared what I was doing with my bombers, and I explained it was the road, and you just had this shit-eaten grin on your face, and you said, okay, go for it.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, so do you have any planes to scramble? You said, no. The grin was still there. The bombs went off, the road was destroyed, the grin remains. And even now, it's fucking creeping up again on your face again.
Yeah.
So what's going on there, man?
I've got a plan.
Explain.
I'm not going to tell you.
It's wild. It's actually against the rules.
You'll see next stop stage.
Okay. I think you're going to try and repair the road.
No.
then I have no idea what this is.
I was going to repair the road before you bombed more of it, but I've changed.
Right, okay, that's interesting. So the shit-eating grin is about this other plan that isn't repairing the road.
I was going to repair the road and do this other plan. I'm mm-hmm. now just going to do the other plan and leave the road fucked up.
That's interesting. I actually don't know what this will be. So, okay. Colour me interested.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
We will, as is the nature of the game.
Yep.
And that was it for the air combat, the air missions.
Yeah, we flew through it.
Sorry, did you just congratulate yourself on a pun?
Yes.
That's very me-coded.
I thought I'd take the role.
But no, 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 we're not swapping. I'm not doing a history segment this week.
Oh, then we're not doing it.
Ah, I see. You're waiting on me to come up with one for this week. Right, I see.
Just spitball it.
No, to be fair, we'll swap. You can do Common Ground this week.
No. yeah, the air combat shaped up nicely. I think turn two's been an interesting one. You seem to have... A lot of stuff seems to have clicked for you this upstage. This turn, sorry.
I've come into my own, Andy.
Yeah.
I've understood what the game is, finally. It's only taken 9 months, but I think I finally figured it out.
Whereas on my end, it's really compounded my fault that I've messed some stuff up.
You do seem to be scrambling in some areas, really trying to dig yourself out of some holes, while I seem to have just gotten out of the holes, but they were big holes. Some people got left behind.
I'll be happy to get out of turn two.
My garrisons are starving, Andy.
That's good. I don't think that's going to matter, because they only lose like 2, then 4, then 6%.
Yeah, just...
By the end of the scenario, you're going to be like, have lost that many.
Yeah, I don't want a situation where they were important and you have to go up against them and they're not there anymore.
Do they not take any cohesion loss?
From starving? I don't think so. I think it is just a flat toe point loss.
I'm going to double check that.
We will have to double check. Because
it feels...
That you can starve them for about 7 turns and it's fine.
Yeah, they lose like 100 guys and then their morale isn't affected.
Well, it's still the practice run, I guess. We've still got time to figure out what starving is.
Yeah, we just need to have a glance over that, because I think you're right. I just, it feels...
I know what you mean. It does feel like it's cheating what hunger actually is in the real world.
It feels like it might be a thing where it's like one of the sub-points in like cohesion or morale, not in the stores section.
Possibly.
Because the store section just has the, like, you can't attack that turn, you can only use half your CPA.
But that's only if you do half ration.
Yeah, which was weird, because half ration shouldn't be worse than no ration.
I guess the thing is with no ration is you then also start to have that attrition. But again, it takes a while
so
for that to kick in.
Slow. Yeah, I think we need to have a look at hunger. We'll be reviewing all the rules before we start the main game, but might have another look at hunger.
And we're coming up to turn 3, so we will have to review hunger rules anyway, because we're going to be feeding people.
Yep.
I need to get on that, by the way, this upstage.
Really?
Yeah, I need to make sure that people have food. What I do have are... Because we need to also finish up the repair phase from the end of turn... Well, upstage 2 of turn 2.
Yeah, you've got some dice to roll, don't you?
I've got some dice to roll. We just thought we'd get the planes out of the way and make it a streamlined one today. And then we can pick that up next week, start that off, figure out what the repair was before we start moving things so we know what we've got to move.
Yeah.
Because I've got a lot of trucks that will come around in the truck convoy phase that could be repaired. As well as some replacement point tanks.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting, because have we destroyed each other's tanks yet, or have they been purely breakdown?
No, just breakdown. We've not done anti-armor.
Yes.
Not once. We've only done it in the practice scenarios that we did, I think.
Yeah.
The
white box.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can use armor to anti-armor, but... I've mainly been fighting your infantry divisions when I've used armor with the 7th.
And the only things I've come across with armor are the 7th, because I've always went for the infantry to try and incur the
combined arms
and utilize that. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see if I get any of those back. But all in all, I think it's a fun start to this op stage. End of turn 2 coming up.
Yeah.
Full steam ahead.
game's clicking.
The game's clicking. The rules are now, some of them, second nature.
Some of them need a check, but I think a check because they're like ingrained and they might be slightly off, but not just a review. But yeah, I agree. I think most of it's coming together, especially the rules we're using.
Yeah.
I need to look at Commonwealth production properly because I think I should have been making trucks maybe at the start of this turn. I don't think I could do it in the fit. There's something in the scenario about when I can start, but it's soon. It's either next turn or I should have done it this turn.
To put you on the spot a bit, what is the rule you feel most comfortable with? If someone was to fire out right now and kind of go, tell me a rule that you know really well, recite it without any rule flaws, or you get shot, what would it be?
Because
I think there's a lot of rules I'm now very comfortable with. I don't think I've got any real problem with the stuff we use upstage to upstage.
I think movement I'm very happy with. I need to check the terrain thing, but that's just for the values.
Yeah.
But the actual how to move stuff feels comfortable. I think all the air stuff feels very comfortable.
I would have said air stuff. Yeah. I would have said bombing. I'm now completely fine reading those tables. That is very, very simplistic.
Yeah.
All it took was figuring out how the bombing stuff works, how do you get your planes from A to B. Once they're there, I'm very comfortable with how air bombardment works.
Yeah.
It's a very simple table, to be fair. It's not much of a brag.
No.
Stuff I'm most unsure about at the moment, I think would probably be maybe anti-armor, now that I'm talking about it. In terms of stuff I'm likely to come across, there's things like scouting that we haven't even touched on, really.
Yeah, but I think anti-armor, because there's the vulnerability stuff.
Oh, that, yes, good point. Same with guns that are in forward positions.
Yeah, which we've not really had to deal with yet, but I mean, for me, the thing that, like, that close assault table, just, I think I'm starting to understand it, but it just really didn't gel with me in terms of, like, work. I think it's simple. I think there's just something about the way I was reading it or something, but that feels weirdly counterintuitive.
The weird thing is, we were really good with it the first, I think maybe full turn, or at least the first two upstages, we were fine with that. And then something happened in turn two where there was that time, maybe it was upstage one, where we were trying to figure it out and we both had a complete breakdown trying to figure it out.
I think we moved from like skirmishes of like very small groups to like divisions smashing into each other.
Yeah, maybe it was the stress of having to figure out everything else and then look at a table. The table felt like it should have been more complicated.
I think that's part of it, is that like there's only one value for both of you, and yeah, there's just something about it that I'll get it, but it doesn't feel intuitive.
Well, on the upside, that's another week of it done, Andy. We can tick that one off.
Yeah,
it's over. We can put it in the deserts of our mind, and we can leave it there until next week. We'll probably continue with the rest of the episode, I suppose. We'll not wrap it
feels
up
like
just
we
yet.
Should, yeah.
Yeah, I guess people are used to an episode that's longer than 20 minutes of us talking about the game and then doing nothing else. We tend to spiral a little bit and talk about stuff that's kind of unrelated. Thankfully, we do have a bit of an anchor.
We do.
People sending in mail.
Yes.
And for the most part, it's usually related directly to the game and questions about the game.
Or fun tangents.
Fun tangents are also good. They keep us anchored in our own psyche. And this week, I believe we've got a little bit of a mixture.
We do.
And the first piece of mail we have is from Tyler. And the subject is regarding randomized democracy. So this is more along the line of tangent.
Yeah, this is a common ground of mine, well, a few episodes ago.
Yeah, you point out actually episode 44.
There we go.
Greetings, you two excellent gentlemen. Oh, us? You talking about us? Well, thank you.
I'll take it.
Thanks for all the work you put into such a great podcast. Oh, us? Talking about us? It's becoming less and less realistic. I just want to point out that the Common Ground segment, I love, by the way, this is capitalized. Common Ground.
Well, it's a proper noun.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's good. That really gives it some oomph.
Yeah.
That's good. segment of episode 44 about a new version, that's quotation, of democracy that involved randomly appointing MPs from a pool of eligible voters. MPs are members of parliament, for those who don't have a parliament. Which, no, I say that, there's a lot of political terms that I read from other countries where it's probably commonplace. And for me, I'm just like, I don't know what this is. Yeah. I Google it and I'm like, this is probably just something everyone knows. From a pool of eligible voters, which you both rejected as obviously insane, is, in fact, exactly how democracy in ancient Greece worked. The, I'll butcher this, B-O-U-L-E, the boule?
Yeah.
Is that right? You don't know that for sure. You're just giving me a pat on the back without knowing what it's for.
It looks correct to me.
The legislative body of ancient Athens was comprised of 500 randomly appointed eligible citizens who served for only 1 year and could not be reappointed. Magistrates were also appointed at random. To prevent cherry-picking of appointees, the Athenians invented a device called the clericteria that efficiently randomized the available names. This and a series of other checks and balances apparently worked quite well to limit corruption. The system of randomized appointment, called sortition by political scientists, was also used by several Italian city-states in the Renaissance and Switzerland as late as 1837. I agree, it sounds bonkers and ripe for corruption and paper, but it has a track record of at least some degree of success spanning thousands of years. And frankly, even if the result is unmitigated chaos, as an American, I fail to see a meaningful difference between that and my country's current system. I say give it a go. Stay subtle, humble, and brave. Tyler. Well, Tyler, there are some very poignant things you point to there. Now that we're in the far future and everything's perfect politically, I'm not sure what part of America's history you're referring to. I could hazard a guess, but... when it comes to the fact that in deep history, it's been used before, Andy, maybe you're a genius.
I mean, great minds think alike, and I'm up there with Plato, Aristotle.
Or maybe the likes of Plato and Aristotle back in the day would have just ended up playing a board game for too long and started a podcast. But back then, there was just a vacuum of political power, and people like them just fell into it. And to be fair, they also weren't politicians, were they?
They would have been citizens. I don't know if they ever got elected.
Yeah, I don't think they were. Yeah, I doubt they put together the function of this. So I don't know. Maybe there's some spark of ingenuity in what you put together in that common ground. Maybe
I just need a clericteria to remove any chance of corruption.
Just like random number generators online. Just use those. They've already got them.
Yeah,
we've got a clericteria. we've got them. We found the clericteria. Most people have difficulty finding the clericteria, but we found it.
So now we just need to pop that system into play.
Oh, it's blue humor. It really is. It's really, really lazy comedy, but it's good. So, yeah, I think the fact that it's been used fairly recently as well by Italy of all places.
Yeah.
Italy, of course, very big on our historical radar.
Yeah.
At present. 1837 for Switzerland. So Europe had it going on.
I mean, people say Athens, a lot of sort of thought comes from there, geometry stuff. Then people were dumb for several, like 1,000 years, or maybe even 2,000. And then the Renaissance happened. Again, under this system. Maybe it's a good one.
So you think that you're going to kickstart intelligence again by talking about this on the Common Ground segment of episode 44 of War with a Mate?
Yeah, I'm going to invent thinking 3.0.
No, don't. Don't reinvent the wheel. And certainly don't reinvent it by using a hammer to make it into a square shape. You should not be in charge of any political system whatsoever, Andy. I'm sorry.
Why am I doing this?
I love you, man. You've got so many good qualities, but leading some sort of political movement should not be one of them. I can't allow that. I really can't. And if you get anywhere close to that, I'll have to bring you down. I'll cancel you.
You can't cancel me.
I can. I'll trick you into saying something on the microphone. So many things you could say. So many things. But we'll not do that. We'll stay friends.
Another thing I could say is this email from Jack.
Okay, yeah, let's say that. Let's say it out loud. And let's keep this, I guess, relatively on track.
Hello. Noting that you're projecting the game will take you decades to complete, but the real-life campaign for North Africa only took 4 years, can you calculate the ratio between your gameplay speed and the real-life speed of the war?
Slow.
I'll say this. A turn is a week. We're just finishing up turn two.
It's been about 9 months, so...
40-odd episodes, so yeah.
If anyone could do the quick maths right now off the top of your head, you can probably put it together. I don't really want to think about it. I could probably get a calculator out and check. I'm not keen on the idea, because it's probably going to send me into some sort of spiral, and I won't sleep tonight.
Oh, well, you might have actually answered his next question then. How does it feel knowing that you could have actually fought the whole of World War II, probably multiple times over, in less time than it will take you to play this game?
Well, Jack, I can barely fight this fight on a map that I have complete control over, complete autonomy, and the means of all technology that I want in order to keep track of things. If I was in the actual campaign, I'd be dead in... I wouldn't get there. I would die, I think, en route. I don't have the best diet anyway.
You're just gonna die on a transport.
Yeah, I feel like I'd be unsafe on a boat, and it would kill me. So... I guess I don't need to worry about that too much, but in terms of the scale of it, I think we acknowledged a long time ago that this was always going to be longer than the actual campaign. Yeah. And yeah,
to be fair, they were doing that war 24/7.
And there was of them.
Yeah.
This is a game meant for 10
players.
If we
were playing this 24/7 with northwards of a million people, that made too many chefs spoil.
Is that what happened with the wall? Were there too many chefs spoiling the broth?
It would have been much easier if you had less guys.
Yeah, that's it. Just do a nice, concise 10-man wall, and that would be fine.
As another thought, are there any other board games that take longer to play than the real-life concept they are representing? My best thought is a racing game, something like Heat Pedal to the Metal, which is a game about cars driving 2 laps around a racetrack. The game takes about 60 minutes, but real cars can do 2 laps of Silverstone, for example, in 3 minutes. Stay brash, arrogant, and cowardly, Jack.
Oh, God, no, Jack's from an alternate universe. Oh, that explains everything, Jack.
He's from the dark timeline.
Oh, he's from the bad universe, where the campaign for North Africa was a game worth buying and playing. That's an interesting one. I like the idea of a board game that's racing cars around a track.
Yeah, that sounds fun. I also do like the idea of a game that takes less... that takes longer to play than the thing it's, like, representing.
I guess, in a way, Monopoly. Well, it's just the model of capitalism, and realistically, you can lose at that immediately by taking out a loan that's just far too much.
Or just being born in the wrong place.
Yeah, that's a good point. The moment you're born, you essentially lose the game. And that's it. The socioeconomic factors mean that it's going to be nigh on impossible to escape all of the crushing debt you will incur. And similar to Monopoly, you may play for the remaining 20, 30 turns, but it's a foregone conclusion. You will not escape. They will take your money. And then eventually you just stop.
I mean, you've taken that to a really dark place.
Well, yeah, but we got asked a question. Jack's from the bad universe, where it's brash, arrogant, and cowardly. I'm being just that.
That is something I might look into, because something else I like is when a sci-fi film, like an old one, is now set in the past.
I love stuff like that.
Yes. Feels like it's up the same sort of alley of, yeah.
One of my favorite game series is the Time Splitters games for PlayStation.
Yeah.
And it's so fun playing through some of those now, and how many levels are set in the past for us now.
Yeah.
And they've all got like laser guns and stuff.
Yeah, it's like in the far future of 2005.
Well, I think, yeah, one of them is 2005. I think the Cyber Den level on the first one is Cyber Den 2005.
Yeah.
And it's all a bunch of cyborgs.
Yeah.
And it's like, 2005, Finding Nemo had just come out the year prior.
I think iTunes that was overly was optimistic new. On their part. But all the Back to the Future films, are they all now set in the past?
Yeah, well, the only one that goes to the future is Back to the Future Part 2, which is 2015. And to be fair, there are some parts of that film that are probably not worth commenting on, really.
Yeah.
There's some parallels that... that film got a lot right, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Hoverboards, in fact, don't work on water. They were correct with that completely. And credit to them.
Another sci-fi film that was set... I think it was 2020. Soylent Green...
Oh, God, it was?
And that predicted Huel.
Oh, that is interesting. You've brought Huel back into the mix.
Ah, oh, fuck.
We haven't talked about Huel in a good while.
I tried one.
And you did. I'm glad you caught yourself there. You saved yourself because I was about to call you out for it. I came into yours a few weeks ago, and what did I see?
A drunk Huel on the floor.
An empty Huel.
The corner shop started selling them. I was like, I'll give this a try. Because I hate the idea of it, but maybe it's implemented well. Didn't care for it.
How does it feel that you've had Huel more recently than me?
Bad.
We need another. We need some more Huel. I need to get back on it.
Actually, that's good, because it means you've stopped drinking Huel.
Yeah, I've gotten to a whole buying cheap sausage rolls thing from Sainsbury's.
Now that I endorse.
Sainsbury's. I've got some in my bag, actually, if you want one.
I had some cheap sausage rolls from Greg's.
They're good, though. They're like premier sausage rolls.
Yeah. They're not cheap, really. Well, they're... I wouldn't describe them as cheap because they're good.
I've got in my bag right now two sausage rolls. They cost 52 pence for two sausage rolls, which I think is pretty good value for money.
Yeah.
One of them, I had a few bags at work because I buy them in sort of full packs. I'm going to toss you a pack here. There you go. That's for you. They are, I think, 27% British pork. Real premium
Where's
stuff.
Where's the rest of the pork from?
Oh, the rest of it isn't pork, Andy. The rest of it is pastry and chemicals.
Ah.
But it's fine. It gets you through the day. It's Aldi price matched as well. That's why it's 52 pence.
Hell yeah.
I don't know what they're price matching because they don't package two sausage rolls like that in Aldi. So I've got no idea what the price match model is. However, what I am sure of is that I am incredibly grateful, Tyler and Jack, for your emails. We love to hear from you folk. And, you know, the fact that these are about the game, it really helps us keep on track to an extent. If you do want to get in touch, send anything over. info@warwithamate.co.uk is the email address. And the Instagram is warwithamate. We take messages on there. We also post stuff on there.
Yeah.
And the web form, Andy, is it working?
Yes, I tested it today.
Awesome. The web form is working. It's confirmed. The website is warwithamate. Forgot the name of the podcast. Yep. warwithamate.co.uk. There's a web form on there. We've got a bunch of pictures of the game on there as well.
Yeah, we recently dumped a bunch of stuff on the gallery, so...
Yeah, check that out if you want to see what the game looks like in action. We'll be organizing that a lot better when we do the full thing. There's a lot of promises for the future. We will get to it. Right now, it's sort of the Wild West. We just want to get through six turns and know how the game works fully. And then, we are really committing to this. It's going to be perfect. It's going to be streamlined. It's going to be the best podcast you've ever heard. Right now, it probably already is. Let's face it. What's out there at the moment? You know, it's just a bunch of celebrities talking about celebrity stuff.
Barren wasteland of content.
This is grassroots shit. This is real working class people doing a real working class thing, like wasting their lives. It's beautiful.
Railing against capitalism, being a worker this week.
Oh, it's great. But, oh God, it's a lovely atmosphere, isn't it? We're all just having a ball. However, it does occur to me, Andy, not everyone's always had a ball. Because this is based on a real event. This is part of World War II. It was hectic, to say the least.
It was a bit of a kerfuffle.
It was. Some real shenanigans happened. And I'm still relatively uninformed on it. I've learned a lot over the last year or so. A lot of it through your history segments. And we ended last week with ABC, his farewell, his temporary swan song, as we said goodbye to his history segment.
Yeah, we got him up to World War II, so he's ready for a couple more episodes.
Yeah, he'll come back in the future. And that means this is going to be a new history segment.
It is.
Who do we have?
I guess the quote will give it away.
Let's hear it.
Now I only have a word more to say about the desert rats. They were the first to begin. The 11th Hussars were in action in the desert in 1940, And ever since, you have kept steadily marching forward on the long road to victory. Through so many countries and changing scenes, you have fought your way. It is not without emotion that I can express to you what I feel about the Desert Rats. Dear Desert Rats, may your glory ever shine. May your laurels never fade. May the memory of this glorious pilgrimage of war, which you have made from Alamein via the Baltic to Berlin, never die. It is a march unsurpassed through all the story of war, so as my many reading of history leads me to believe. May the fathers long tell the children of this tale. That's Winston Churchill talking to the 7th Armored Division in Berlin.
Now, I knew this was coming at some point. I know you've been doing some reading about them, because when we started playing the game, I bought a book about the 7th Armored Division.
Yes.
The Desert Rats. I think it is called Churchill's Desert Rats, the book that I've got.
Yes.
I bought that. I read about maybe a third of it, and then I ended up stopping. I reread House of Leaves. and you borrowed it. And at the time, I didn't know that it was going to be a unit that I would encounter so early in the game. I also didn't realize for a lot of the playing of the game that I was fighting the Desert Rats.
Yes.
Until maybe a month ago. And that's when I realized that's actually who I've been fighting. And I guess you have really sold them short, because everything I know of the 7th Armored Division and the Desert Rats is they are, I mean, the quote you've just read really is a testament to their capability, their impressiveness. And they've just kind of been fucking around in the game so far. So I'm excited to hear how big that disparity is.
Well, it doesn't start great for them, but it gets great. The Mobile Force, which it was originally known as, was formed on the 27th of September 1938 as tensions built between the Axis and the British. It's created because they're concerned about losing Egypt because of the importance of the Suez Canal to the British Empire, which is massive. It consisted of the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, made up of three armoured regiments, the 7th, 8th and 11th Hussars, the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, and it's supported by the 3rd Royal Horse Artillery, and it had a Royal Army Service Corps attached to it and a field ambulance. This is going to be the core that the rest of the 7th will form around, but it is known as the Mobile Force at this point, and it's the equipment it starts with is not great. It's mainly World War One stock, so armoured cars from World War One. Mark V1 tanks, which are old and feeling the strain, and the artillery is equipped with World War One era howitzers.
Okay, yeah, so they're really just scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, here. This is a sort of pulled together thing. In October 1938, it's joined by the 1st Infantry Battalion, the King's Royal Rifle Corps, who in our game are currently deep behind enemy lines on a suicide mission.
Oh my god, the truck bandits.
Yes.
Wow, you've really butchered history.
At this point, the Mobile Force is actually jokingly referred to as the Immobile Force by people in Cairo.
They've got a derogatory nickname. They really are underdogs.
Oh, yeah. And it's just not looking good for them until Major General Percy Hobart shows up. Here's a quote about his accomplishments, just to give you a sense of it. To have moulded the best two British armoured divisions of the war was an outstanding achievement. But Hobart made it a hat-trick by subsequently training the specialised 79th Armoured Division, the decisive factor on D-Day. That's from a historian called Sir Basil Littlehart. This guy is a fantastic commander and trainer, and he whips them into shape here. Really interesting guy in his own right. We mentioned the Rommel Funnies before.
Mm-hmm.
The British version of that is the Hobart Funnies.
Okay.
Just an example of that. He designed floating tanks for D-Day, where they separate the bottom bit from the turret and put basically like hovercraft stuff in it so the tanks could float onto the beach, oh, which allowed them to use heavy armor at D-Day.
Oh, wow.
So, like, a huge accomplishment. Also, the 11th Armored Division is the other unit you trained. That is another one of the most decorated divisions of the war. So
this guy really gets a unit into shape.
Yeah. So during the winter of 1938 to 1939, the division pulls itself together in Cairo and he gets them slightly better equipment, he gets them trained, and in May 1939, they're sent to the Western Desert to put his ideas into practice. He wants all his men to be desert-wise, to be able to live, fight, and win battles in the wastes of the Western Desert. The 1st Royal Tank Regiment had served in the desert before in 1936, so they had considerable experience. And the 11th Hussars, who are Prince Albert's own Hussars, and also referred to as the Cherry Pickers, are the most experienced group they have. It took time to get the division ready for fighting a desert war, like equipment-wise, so he spends that time teaching them desert lore, improving their navigation skills, and fitting sand filters to all their vehicles. With the outbreak of war with Germany on the 3rd of September 1939, the Mobile Division moves up to the Egyptian-Libyan frontier, where it takes a position. With Italy not being quite ready to join the war yet for the Germans, their field training instead of seeing active combat. The first loss the division suffers is actually self-inflicted when the War Office retires General Hobart of his command because he's fallen out with the general in command of the region, Sir Henry Wilson. So he's sent back to Britain and he drives away to a standing ovation from all his men. This is a huge mistake. He may have ended up but he was in charge of defense of the British Isles, which is more of a reserve unit.
Okay.
Until Churchill later on is like, no, this guy knows what he's doing, and gets them to do the 11th Division and then the 79th.
Okay, yeah.
So they get this new general in, Major General Michael Krieger, who is also good. It's not sort of a toady swapping out thing. They are lucky enough to get a new good general.
Oh, right.
And he gets them more better equipment. And throughout this time, they start to change their names. The light armor becomes the 7th Armored Brigade, the heavy armored brigade in the 4th, and the pivot group gains the 2nd Battalion, the 2nd Rifle Brigade, you've also run into.
Yes. Where were they?
They were the infantry unit that was separated when they fought the 4th, the one to the south of them.
Oh, they were the ones who were flanking.
Yes.
Right. Yes, I have run into them.
Yeah. So on the 16th of February 1940, the Mobile Division becomes the 7th Armored Division. And around this time, they also receive the famous Jabora Divisional Sign, which is the desert rat that will give them their name.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. They get this because the General Krieger sees a young local boy with a Jabora in his pocket, and he traces the shape of it in the sand using stones. And then a picture of this is approved and drawn up by one of the troopers in the Royal Tank Regiment, who actually designs the logo. And then the first badges produced were by nurses and given to the divisional HQ, and then they spread out and it became the symbol for this force. And yeah, gained them their name.
So he was the one who, essentially coined the name then?
Yes, which will go on to be, because desert rats can refer specifically to this unit, but it also becomes a generalized phrase for anyone who fights in the Western Desert War is a desert rat.
Okay, so yeah. These are the OG desert rats.
Yes. So on the 10th of June 1940, Italy does join the war. So 4 days later, on the 14th, the King's Royal Rifle Company, the 4th Horse Artillery, and the 7th Hussars capture Fort Capuzzo.
That rings a bell.
Yeah.
Where have I heard that before?
From the map, but...
It's
close to the border.
Yeah, that's come up before. That's a location I actually remember the name of.
While they're doing that, the 11th Hussars simultaneously push and take Fort Magdalena.
Oh! Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
It's life imitating art.
Yeah. 2 days after this, the first tank battle of the... I'm going to call it a tank battle. We'll see in a second. Of the Western Desert campaign takes place. The 11th Hussars come across 2 Italian columns heading to reinforce Fort Capuzzo. The first column is made up of 12 L3/33 tankettes. These are silly vehicles.
I've seen them.
In that, do you know what they look like?
These might These might be the ones. Remember episode 3?
The cappuccino machines.
Yes, we had the Echoes of War guys on.
Yeah.
And they kept on referring to the cappuccino machines. I looked them up afterwards, realized that's what I have. I do know what these are. I've seen them.
Yes, they're little two-man tanks with like a shitty gun and no armor.
Yes.
It's like, why have you even made these?
They look like machines designed to kill Italian men.
Yeah. So they come across a column of 12 of these accompanied by 30 lorries and a second column made up of 17 of them accompanied by 300 infantry. The 11th Hussars regroup and bring up their artillery to assist. And while that's happening, they send two of their armoured cars to attack the column, and they manage to destroy two of these tankettes at the cost of a damaged car. So these cars are heavily armoured and more dangerous than these tankettes.
Well, yeah, it's like cigarellos.
Yes.
It's like, this is not a cigar. This is something else.
These are actual real tanks, what Pluto is to planets. So what follows is called the Battle of Girba, G-I-R-B-A. The Italians form up in a hollow square, which is like Napoleon-era tactics.
Oh, yeah, great. Do that in the desert with your tank.
Yeah. At this square, they conceal one of their four guns at each of the corners, park the trucks in between them, and the infantry are going to use them as cover.
Okay, so they're using the tanks as cover.
The trucks. They also have...
Oh, the trucks.
The tanks are patrolling the borders. Before the tanks are sent after the British armour, unsupported by artillery and infantry, the British tanks, which are supported by them, absolutely smash them. So there's some combined arms for you.
Of course.
So now these tankettes are out of the way. The British A9 cruisers start circling the square, firing at them. As the British artillery starts shelling the right flank of these trucks to expose the infantry. On the tank's second loop, the Italians reveal their hidden artillery and start to shoot the armour. And at this point, the fight essentially breaks up into four engagements, one at each corner between the guns and the tanks. Here, the tanks take out the Italian gunners and the infantry routs.
Of course.
And starts to flee. In the battle, the 11th Hussars destroyed 8 tanks, while the 7th destroyed 9 of these tankettes. All 4 guns were destroyed, and they took over 100 prisoners, basically destroying an Italian infantry battalion and wiping out 2 companies of tanks with, like, a reconnaissance force.
And this also, it's starting to allude to the massive amount of prisoners that were taken during this campaign.
Yes. This could have gone very differently for the Italians, but they made some really major operational and tactical mistakes.
This feels like something we've heard before.
Yep. They only had high explosive ammo with them, but not armor-piercing ammo, which really limited their effectiveness against the British tanks. They had no anti-tank guns in the column.
Why?
Good question, because that's explicitly against Italian military doctrine at the time.
All right, so this wasn't... They weren't caught with their pants down.
They were...
They'd be negligent.
Yes, it was... And then there were mistakes were all compounded by using the tankettes incorrectly and not having a combined arms thing with them.
Right, so the combined arms thing has some historical precedent here. This is actually... No, this is really interesting. This actually speaks to why the rule really does have some sense to it. Because I've always thought this when we've been playing the game, it's not an odd thing, but I've tried to visualize it a lot about these infantry garrisoning the armor and how it would be ineffective. But the fact that this actually seems like there is a reason for it to be ineffective.
Yeah, also tanks, someone might correct me on this, tanks aren't great at this time as anti-personnel.
Well, I guess,
like for breaking up fortifications, attacking buildings and cities, but they've got like typically one main gun with maybe 2 or 3 machine guns on them, which are effective against infantry. But if you've got like several thousand infantry running at 10 tanks,
they win.
They win just because the tanks need support.
Yeah. No, I guess I've always had a sort of blind spot in my mind where I was like, well, it's a tank. If you're men, the tank's going to win. But thinking about it logistically, you can only take out so many men before they're just upon the tank.
Yeah,
So even if they're just getting into the tank, that's bad. But they can also take out the gunners and, yeah.
So this is, I believe this is the first direct engagement on like a, they've obviously attacked these forts, but this is the first sort of two forces really coming together of the Western Desert Campaign. Certainly the first tank battle. While all that's happening, the 11th also captured the engineer-in-chief of the Italian 10th Army. They managed to get him, one of his staff officers, two of their lady friends who were in the car with them.
Why are you bringing your lady friends out into the front?
It just makes no sense. But even more importantly, he's carrying maps, because he's the chief engineer, of the defences around Bardia.
Oh my god.
Which is important later on for the Allies' strategy. This guy really fucks up.
Yeah, so this guy has... Yeah, this is like if... Yeah, I was going to make a Death Star comparison of someone having the Death Star plans, but is also bringing along his lady friends. Just stop bringing civilians out into the front lines of the desert war.
Yeah, it's just bizarre. Despite their success here, they don't have the men to hold the garrisons they've taken, which is why you have them at the start of the game.
Right, okay.
So they have to leave, and the Italians recapture and garrison Fort Capuzzo. Despite this and the raids they're doing, it's not really slowing down the Italian buildup. It's sort of a nuisance, but it's not a major setback. But while this is happening, they were going to send more of the division's tanks forward, but they decided not to avoid breakdowns and supply issues. So the majority of the 7th Armored Division's tanks are up Mersa Matruh at this point, which left one tank regiment with the 1st King's Royal Rifle Company, with an additional 2 infantry battalions and their artillery, monitoring a 60-mile section of the border.
Ooh, big portion.
Yeah. The Hussars, their instructions were to harass any Italian probes and to attempt to delay, but not get seriously engaged in an offensive.
Okay.
So between the 11th of June and the 9th of September, they inflicted 3,500 Italian casualties for the loss of 150 men.
That seems like more than just harassing.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the strength of the tanks in the division rose to 70 at Mersa Matruh, active, with an additional 15 being repaired from wear and tear. So they're really building up their force here. Which brings us up to Friday the 13th, September 1940, when a 9-lived piece of shit called Rodolfo Graziani begins his offensive. And that, we brought it up to the start of the game, and we'll find out more about what they did during the actual conflict coming up next week.
Oh, wow. And that's interesting because Friday 13th, of course, spooky date.
Yeah.
Next week's episode will release on Halloween.
Ooh.
So the arrival of the spooky figure of Graziani and his haunting effect on the North African campaign.
Yeah.
Very fitting, very thematic. That's tied in very nicely.
But this is, yeah, this is a unit that's just continually impressive from basically the time Hobart gets his hands on them till they take Berlin.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but high regard held for them through everything I've seen and read.
Yeah.
So I think finding out more about these will be really interesting.
Yeah. Well, the fact Churchill, who, despite what you want to say about him, is a fairly legitimate historian in his own right and leading the country through this war, is describing them as having a story unmatched in the history of war, is very impressive.
Yeah, that's it. The guy, if he's giving an accolade to something, he probably means it from the point of they had an influence and a significant one. And again, I feel like, and this is again coming from a layman who knew nothing about the North African campaign when we got the game, I don't believe the North African campaign is a part of the war that is held in the sort of typical annals of history where it's spoke about a lot. So for a unit to be as heavily decorated and recognized, it really speaks to what capability they brought to the conflict.
Yeah, I think that's a thing of it being sort of not taught, at least in schools with us, because there's some... The 28th Maori went through there, the 2nd New Zealand went through there, who are going to get an episode at some point. are very impressive. One of them is the only person to win two Victoria Crosses in the whole war.
Yeah, so we're talking about people with like real accolades.
Some really very impressive units in the Western Desert campaign. And obviously, it's where Rommel made his legend as well. So I think there is stuff that sort of leaks out of it, but I agree, I knew nothing about it before we started.
I was going to make a weird point there of, it seems like a lot of the people listening have a lot of knowledge about all of this and drop it in. Thing is, I bet a lot of the people listening are probably quite interested in this portion of history.
Yeah.
Probably why they came across this in the first place.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll drop that comparison. And that's a non-comment.
But it is a really interesting theory and a very unique theater.
Yeah.
Is why you get the SAS from here and the Long Range Desert Group, and they're trying weird things as well.
Yeah, after when you're dealing with an environment that's been seldom fought in with this kind of warfare.
Yeah, fought in for the first time on this mechanized scale, because deserts were something you went through to have a fight. You didn't fight in the desert.
And this could also be very uninformed, but I'll say it as well. Maybe never again. Was there ever a war like this in this environment? There's been obviously wars in this kind of climate, but fought in this specific, it's sort of a weird portion of history where it's fully mechanized warfare, but it's not quite, you know, we're not talking like drone warfare.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the kind of technology available now in modern war. It is somewhere between.
Yeah. I'd maybe have to look at, well, I would have to look into that more to give you a good answer, but there's also the thing of like a lot of the wars we consider to be happening in deserts now, in like the Middle East and stuff, that like, I remember in the Ralph Bagnall's book, Liberty and Sands, he goes, there's two types of deserts.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I think this is the one that's happening in the second more extreme type of desert.
Yes, this is like middle of nowhere desert. This is complete waste.
Like, I think very few conflicts happen like 200 miles from a city.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird, such a vast space they're fighting in. Whereas like the fighting in Europe is so dense.
It's urban for the most part.
I guess maybe the distance, the Pacific theater might be comparable, where the dangerous vast environment is the ocean.
Yes.
Rather than the desert. But
the third type of desert.
Probably, the two comparably dangerous environments, potentially.
Yeah, it just genuinely interests me. It fascinates me, and it terrifies me. Yeah. And sometimes it's scary when we go from playing the game and it's fairly lighthearted because we're just doing spreadsheets and not really enjoying a lot of the game, and then enjoying parts of it. And that's the conflict we have. And then I learn about the history, and I'm like, this was real. Yeah. This isn't. I was going to say this isn't Monopoly. We've just touched on the fact that's also dark and real.
We've also seen Jaboras.
Oh, we did.
We saw them in
Budapest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a Budapest Zoo.
Not quite the common Gundy.
No. No, they were cool. But I guess another weird link into Hungary, since we're mentioning it, the name Hussars was the Hungarian light cavalry, and the British co-opted the name for its light cavalry, which then became tank regiments. So like the 11th Hussars and the 7th Hussars and stuff. That name traces also to Hungary.
All roads lead to Hungary.
Yeah.
That's what they say. The roads, they're long, they're winding, and they involve both of us, you and I.
They do.
Hungary did, and this game does, and the conflict will for the foreseeable future. We will spend, I mean, if you take about, you know, how long we've known each other now, by the time we finish this, most of our time knowing each other will have spent playing this game.
Yes.
Which means we need to stay friends, Andy.
We do. And what do you got for me?
It's, you know what's coming. It's common ground.
And now for something nicer. A little oasis in the war. It's time for some common ground. I'm trying the intro for common ground. I'm recording it. Maybe.
Common Ground is the segment in which we need to find it. We need to be able to get a place where we can agree, where we can drop the conflict of the game. We can just find a topic to agree on, no matter how difficult that may be. And I've come prepared, as always, for my week, because we alternate. It's only fair. And I have an idea for Common Ground. The Common Ground is that the bus driver should be thanking me. I shouldn't be thanking them.
Okay, you're going to have to do a lot of work to get me to agree with you here. What?
I've had a few bad experiences on the bus recently.
Okay.
So this is, I guess, one of the more, I wouldn't say selfish and indulgent Common Ground ideas, but...
I would.
Yeah, but that's why we need to agree on it eventually, Andy. So, the issue is we've got that celebrity in the corner who's completely... misunderstands everything. That's the issue with having a celebrity guest on every episode. And that they've been quiet up until, what, like episode 40-odd? And now they're trying to pipe up in the background as if they've ever got the bus.
They don't have a mic.
Yeah, for good reason, you know, after what, you know, they did. I think that was a media PR crisis, but we'll not get into that.
So why should we scorn bus drive?
You know, I think there's just a little something about when I go to get on the bus, and I go to get on, and there's this weird tension when I ask for a ticket. So I had a situation not too long ago where I got into the bus and I said, and I hadn't gotten the bus for a while at this point, by the way. We're talking years. I get the train for the most part. And that's easy because you go to a machine, you buy the ticket, and the ticket is sort of, you know, what area do you want to go to? You buy the ticket, you get on, and occasionally you'll get it checked depending on whether or not inspectors are about, but that's sort of it.
Just to say, you're saying this is easy. The last time we tried to get a train together, we got a bus because the train didn't work.
That was... No, it's not that the train didn't work.
We couldn't get the train.
The train was not in
service. Because it wasn't running.
Somebody died on the tracks.
Okay, I didn't know if we needed to say that.
So we couldn't get the train. It was a tragedy. So we got the bus as the alternative. So
okay, but yes, trains are easy and they work properly.
Yeah, they are, for the most part. I guess in Britain, trains aren't necessarily... I guess we're getting off topic. Trains are bad. If I had to say thank you to a train driver, I probably also would maybe have some contention with that.
Okay, yeah, but we're getting sidetracked. What's the problem with buses, then?
So I went to get on, and yeah, trains are easy, but you go to get on the bus, and I said, can I have a day ticket, please? And... they went, why do you want a day ticket? And I'm like, do you usually do this? Do you usually question the validity of me wanting to buy a ticket? So I was like, I would like a day ticket. And he went, well, why? It's more expensive. And my first thought was, more expensive than what exactly?
Yeah.
Because you don't know what my journey today is going to look like. I could be getting 15 single tickets, and that's going to mount up to surely beyond a day ticket.
Isn't a day ticket cheaper than
two singles?
Yeah.
So it turns out, no. At the moment, it is cheaper to get two singles than a day ticket. A day ticket, your savings really come from three or more singles. But I didn't know that. Apparently, you didn't know that either. Which, that's completely fine, isn't it? It's fine to not know how much economic value you're going to get from a day ticket.
Yeah. Because, you see, when I get the bus to work... I get two singles because I kept losing the day ticket.
that's a fun other angle you've got on this, but I like it. It all plays into the bus meta.
Okay.
So I then say, okay, well, what is the... can I have a return ticket then?
Well, the people behind you are this.
Yes.
And there's like a full bus of people watching you.
There are. That's why I hate this.
Okay.
That is why I hate the situation. That is what really... puts me on edge here, because it makes me feel like this bus driver, and I need to be very clear here, this is not all bus drivers. I bet there are a ton of bus drivers out there that are just absolute saints, just lovely people, and they don't want to inconvenience anyone. They're probably just going about their day. But after this event, I've got the bus more. This isn't the only time I've had issues with bus drivers.
Okay.
But in this instance, I then say, well, I'll have... a return ticket. And he said, we don't do return tickets. So now I'm in this awkward position where I'm like, well, I feel like you're asking me to ask you, well, what are the tickets?
What do I do?
But I'm not going to give them the satisfaction. So instead I say, well, I'll have a day ticket, please. And he says, well, fine, that'll be £8. And I go, okay, fine.
That's expensive.
And he rolls his eyes as I pay £8 towards this company, the system he's part of. I'm giving money into this organization that he's part of. And he's upset about it. He's angry. And I don't know why. I don't know what I've done wrong. I don't know what the logistics of this are. I found out afterwards that a single is £2.50.
Yeah.
So if I'm getting two singles, which by chance I was for that day, I'm getting two singles. I'm getting a journey there, journey back, £5. It's less than the £8. So he was going to save me money with a day ticket. The thing is, I don't know that, and he knows I don't know that. I asked for a day ticket. Does he say that to everyone who buys a day ticket? Every time someone buys a day ticket, does he say, why do you want a day ticket? That's wild. In what other profession do you do that? Does someone ask to buy something and you go, I get upselling. This is not upselling. This is downselling.
Well, that's him being he's looking out for you.
I don't think it is.
Not in a way you liked, but he's trying to save you some money.
I'd like to think, Annie, I can read social cues to a degree. And the way he was talking was not someone who's looking out for my best interests. This was a man who had it in for me.
Okay.
And I don't know why, because I definitely haven't met the man before, because I hadn't got buses in years. And then since then, I've had more of these situations where I imagine this is fairly commonplace across the world, anywhere where there's buses, where there's some sort of like bus card or pass or, I was going to say loyalty card. I don't know all the terms for buses. I don't like them. But instead of tapping your debit or credit card on a contactless payment, there's a bus card you can get. Whatever brand it is, whatever it is, wherever you are. And I asked for a ticket. I went to pay contactless. And it said, tap card. And it was there immediately. And I put my card on. And he went, no, not yet. And I was like, oh, okay. It said tap card. I was just thinking internally, why did it say tap card? So then I went to do it again. And I was again too fast. And he went, no, not yet. And he's getting more annoyed. And there's again people behind me. And I'm sweating now. I don't know what's going on. I'm like, why is my card, why am I not being allowed to tap my card? And well, I got onto the bus afterwards. On my third attempt, it did actually pay. Because I came up with the price, £2.50, paid for it, sat down. Person I was with said, yeah, that's for the bus card. That's when you've got the card and you tap that down first. And then it takes on the cost onto your card, your bus card.
Yeah.
I'm like, right, okay. But I don't know that. And I know that this bus driver does this day in, day out. This is their job. They probably get sick of people who are inept with buses. But by the same merit, it's always going to be someone's first day on the bus. It's not fair to chastise them. It's not. I'm not trying to make that job inconvenient. I'm trying to get on the bus and go somewhere. And I'll always be courteous. I'll always get off the bus. I'll say thank you. Even on those instances, I said thank you.
I do actually have a similar thing with the buses when I get them from outside of here.
Yeah.
Because there's a lower rate if you don't go quite as far.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say, oh, I want to go into town, they'll be like, where? And the first time I started getting buses again once I moved here, I was like, town? Why does it matter?
Why does it matter?
And then it's like, oh, I'm going here. And then he's like, oh, that's less, you know. It's like, no, I didn't. But again, they're looking out for you. They're saving you money.
Yes, I suppose they are. But why does it have to be a battle? Why does it have to be passive-aggressive? The thing is, the amount of back and forth it took between the, well, why do you want that? There's no such thing as a return ticket. They could have just easily said, by the way, a day ticket is £8, two singles are £5. And I'd go, oh, sorry, in that case I'll have a single. I'll get another single later. So I'm thanking these people. I'm getting off the bus. I'm being courteous. But I feel like just a little bit of humility. Maybe that's how we balance this out. Just Just a fucking hair would be nice. Just a little bit of give back. Maybe I don't need a thank you. Maybe I just need courtesy. I just need to know that they don't hate me. I can't deal with getting on a bus and feeling like I'm in the wrong. Because I'm not. I'm just getting on a bus.
A lot of places in Europe, you don't get on and talk to the driver at all.
That feels worse.
Like they're halfway down the train and then you just tap the card when you get on.
I don't know, that feels worse. Like, do you have to go past them when you get on?
No, they're like doors are...
Oh, in the middle?
Yeah.
Right, okay. See, I would feel bad if I was walking past the driver and I didn't acknowledge them at all.
Yeah, that's...
I feel like that would be rude. Yeah. Because you're going right past the person doing it. Same way if on a train you had to like get on near the... And they said cockpit, that's not what trains have. if I had to get on at the cabin and I wasn't saying anything, I'd feel rude.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's this disconnect. Where do you sit on this?
I've come round a bit. Okay. Because when you first said it, it was nuts.
I don't know.
They certainly shouldn't applaud you.
I had to go... I never said applaud. Thank.
Okay. I'll also say that. They shouldn't have to thank you. But, yeah, I guess it's... I do agree with the thing of if you've not taken a bus for a while, you don't know the, like, bus rules.
Exactly. It's... And you know what the thing is as well? Where the fuck do you find them?
Find...
The bus rules.
Oh, yeah, there's no, like...
Like, trains, it's fine. You can usually look online. They've got, like, sort of sheets of, like, you go from this zone to this zone, you buy this ticket. Where... There's not that for buses. You have to deal with the interaction on the bus. And in what situation do you have enough time and comfort to go onto the bus and ask the bus driver? There is no situation in which that's not going to end with a passive-aggressive comment.
Yeah, this isn't on the drivers, this is on the bus companies. Also, I think the ones with doors in the middle are trams, not buses.
Oh, fair enough. That's somewhere between train and bus.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you mean. It is a weird experience getting on the bus when you don't know what you're doing and you're just, as an adult, being like, please help me.
Yeah, I just want public transport to be fine. I just want to be able to get on. I'm saving the planet here, you know. I'm doing a good thing, objectively. I think that should just be at least, not praised, that's crazy, but acknowledged. I should be let off a little bit for not knowing the bus rules, is what I'm saying. I just want to get on the bus.
That's fair. Yeah, you've actually got me round. I do think the common ground could be that bus rules should be less opaque.
Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that. Bus rules should be less opaque.
Yeah, it's not on the drivers. The company shouldn't be delegating it to the drivers.
Yes, the responsibility should not be put on the drivers. They're there to drive a bus. That's their job. That's what they're getting paid for. They shouldn't have to explain it. Visibility of the bus rules would solve all of this.
Yeah, you got the timetable and then you...
Yeah, timetable, this is what you need to pay to get to this area. It's got how long it'll take to get to the places. That's wrong, by the way. It's a lie. But it should also have how much the ticket costs.
Well, I came down my street after COVID. And they... Not COVID, but for some reason the bus... Oh, the buses went on strike here a while ago. And then I knew everything was back to normal when I was walking down my street. And I saw... Four buses with the same... They're the same number. Like, they're on the same route. They are meant to be 15 minutes apart. All visible. Coming on my street at the same time. Having a, like, stop. And then everyone who's waiting for the bus gets on the first one. But people want to get off the free behind it. So they have to stop anyway. And I just walking down the street going, there's four buses there, like, everything's back to normal.
Well, you know what they say, Andy. You wait for a bus, and then two come along at the same time.
Yeah.
But, for now, you'll have to wait until next week for the next one to come along. Because unlike this week, this week last week we saw two episodes posted at the same time. It's the same episode twice. You don't have to listen to it twice. There's nothing extra, there's nothing special. That was a that? No, there's not. Don't put that in people's mind. There's not. The same episode appeared twice on Spotify and everything else. We don't know why.
And we can't fix it.
We objectively can't fix it. Unless we delete the episode, we can't fix that. But next week, it will be one episode. This week is one episode.
We don't know why that happened, so let's not promise anything.
That's a good point. You could be listening to this twice again. But what I am saying is goodbye. It's good night. It's farewell.
Thank you very much for listening. Yes. Stay subtle, humble, and brave.
And stay safe getting on that bus to drive through the deserts of your mind. I wish they'd advertise those routes.